Listening Comprehension Test. Task 1. Questions and Answers. Listen to a BBC radio show with 5 questions and answers on science and technology. While listening, match each speaker 1 to 5 with a heading which sums up the answer he or she receives, A to G. Put the corresponding letter into the correct box. For each speaker, there is only 1 correct answer. There are 2 more headings than you need. You will hear the recording twice. After listening, you will have some extra time to complete the task. You now have 1 minute to read the task below. The recording starts now.
This is the Q&A podcast from BBC Focus magazine. Hello everyone, I'm Gareth Mitchell and I present Click, the technology programme on BBC World Service. And I'm here to answer your questions on science and technology. So let's take the first one. It comes from Sarah O'Brien in Southampton.
Why is the Arctic warming faster than the rest of the planet?
Yes, whilst the average temperature of the Earth has increased by around 0.8 degrees Celsius over recent decades, the Arctic is warming twice as fast. In fact, recent research by climatologists suggests that this is because of a peculiar atmospheric layer over the Arctic that traps in heat that would otherwise escape. And that effect is being compounded by the disappearance of highly reflective sea ice. All right, let's have our next question.
Is the Great Wall of China really visible from space? Chris Tuttle, Edinburgh.
Well, let's take the myth out of that one, because no, you cannot see the Great Wall of China from space. Even from low Earth orbit, the Great Wall is extremely hard to spot with the naked eye, and that's because it's basically a thin line and it's almost the same colour as the landscape around it. However, lots of other things are visible, including cities, airports and dams. Although, here's an interesting fact for you. From the moon, you can't see any man-made structure.
Will we have more electricity blackouts in the future? Susie Lane, Poole.
Well, yes, I'm afraid we will. At least that's according to a joint study published earlier this year by the Universities of Lincoln and Auckland. And the study analysed energy supply and consumption across the major Western countries. And it projected an 80% growth in demand worldwide by 2035. And that would require 5,900 additional gigawatts of power. And if we continue to build power stations at the present rate, supply will fall short and the lights will, I'm afraid, go off more often.
Why do we get used to smells? Paul Meller, St Albans.
Well, that's because our nervous system has evolved to become progressively less sensitive to a stimulus the longer it persists. So it's a bit like if there's a constant background noise, you eventually kind of tune it out with your ears. And this enables us to concentrate on the newer sensations that are more likely to be an opportunity or a threat. We also have an olfactory memory that discards smells that we've experienced recently. And that means you don't notice the smell of your house when you come home from work. But it does smell a bit strange when you come back from holiday, and that's why. Let's have our final question.
Why can we see clearer when we squint? Katie Scott, Canterbury.
Well, let's see if I can get this right. Squawking uses the much less of the chokes. Oh, I can't see that very well. Hang on. Let's try squinting. Oh, that's better. Squinting uses the muscles of the cheeks and the eyebrows to close up the eye. Now, that blocks out some of the light, so yes, the image is darker. But what's left is light coming in at the shallowest angles, and your eye doesn't need to bend these rays of light as much to bring them to a nice point on your retina, so the image is in focus. And indeed, you can exploit this effect to make a pair of reading glasses by putting pinholes in a piece of cardboard and looking through that. So if you've lost your glasses, then just find some cardboard and a pin. That's my advice for the end of this podcast. We'll leave it there, but we'd like to have more of your questions for the next edition, so do send them in. You can email us via questions@sciencefocus.com, and on Facebook, we're facebook.com/sciencefocus. On Twitter, we're @sciencefocus, and do use the hashtag #focast. Well, I'm Gareth Mitchell, and I'll be back with more answers to your questions next month. See you then. This is the Q&A podcast from BBC Focus magazine. Hello everyone, I'm Gareth Mitchell, and I present Click, the technology programme on BBC World Service, and I'm here to answer your questions on science and technology. So let's take the first one. It comes from Sarah O'Brien in Southampton.
Why is the Arctic warming faster than the rest of the planet?
Yes, whilst the average temperature of the Earth has increased by around 0.8 degrees Celsius over recent decades, the Arctic is warming twice as fast. In fact, recent research by climatologists suggests that this is because of a peculiar atmospheric layer over the Arctic that traps in heat that would otherwise escape. And that effect is being compounded by the disappearance of highly reflective sea ice. All right, let's have our next question.
Is the Great Wall of China really visible from space? Chris Tuttle, Edinburgh.
Well, let's take the myth out of that one, because no, you cannot see the Great Wall of China from space. Even from low Earth orbit, the Great Wall is extremely hard to spot with the naked eye, and that's because it's basically a thin line and it's almost the same colour as the landscape around it. However, lots of other things are visible, including cities, airports and dams. Although, here's an interesting fact for you. From the moon, you can't see any man-made structure.
Will we have more electricity blackouts in the future? Susie Lane, Poole.
Well, yes, I'm afraid we will. At least that's according to a joint study published earlier this year by the universities of Lincoln and Auckland. And the study analysed energy supply and consumption across the major Western countries. And it projected an 80% growth in demand worldwide by 2035. And that would require 5,900 additional gigawatts of power. And if we continue to build power stations at the present rate, supply will fall short and the lights will, I'm afraid, go off more often.
Why do we get used to smells? Paul Meller, St Albans.
Well, that's because our nervous system has evolved to become progressively less sensitive to a stimulus the longer it persists. So it's a bit like if there's a constant background noise, you eventually kind of tune it out with your ears. And this enables us to concentrate on the newer sensations that are more likely to be an opportunity or a threat. We also have an olfactory memory that discards smells that we've experienced recently. And that means you don't notice the smell of your house when you come home from work. But it does smell a bit strange when you come back from holiday, and that's why. Let's have our final question.
Why can we see clearer when we squint? Katie Scott, Canterbury.
Well, let's see if I can get this right. Squawking uses the much less of the chokes. Oh, I can't see that very well. Hang on. Let's try squinting. Oh, that's better. Squinting uses the muscles of the cheeks and the eyebrows to close up the eye. Now, that blocks out some of the light, so yes, the image is darker. But what's left is light coming in at the shallowest angles, and your eye doesn't need to bend these rays of light as much to bring them to a nice point on your retina, so the image is in focus. And indeed, you can exploit this effect to make a pair of reading glasses by putting pinholes in a piece of cardboard and looking through that. So if you've lost your glasses, then just find some cardboard and a pin. That's my advice for the end of this podcast. We'll leave it there. But we'd like to have more of your questions for the next edition, so do send them in. You can email us via questions@sciencefocus.com. And on Facebook, we're facebook.com/sciencefocus. On Twitter, we're @sciencefocus. And do use the #HashFocast. Well, I'm Gareth Mitchell, and I'll be back with more answers to your questions next month. See you then.
That is the end of this task. Task 2. Plastic. Listen to Diana Cohen talking about an environmental problem. While listening, tick the correct answer, A, B, C, or D. There is only one correct answer. You will hear the recording twice. After listening, you will have some extra time to complete the task. You now have 2 minutes to read the task below. The recording starts now.
I'm a visual artist, and I'm also one of the co-founders of the Plastic Pollution Coalition. I've been working with plastic bags, which I cut up and sew back together as my primary material for my artwork for the last 20 years. I turn them into 2- and 3-dimensional pieces and sculptures and installations. Upon working with the plastic, after about the first 8 years, some of my work started to fissure and break down into smaller little bits of plastic. And I thought, great, it's ephemeral, just like us. Upon educating myself a little further about plastics, I actually realized this was a bad thing. It's a bad thing that plastic breaks down into smaller little bits because it's always still plastic. And what we're finding is that a lot of it is in the marine environment. I then, in the last few years, learned about the Pacific Garbage Patch and the gyre. And my initial reaction, and I think that this is a lot of people's first reaction to learning about it, is, oh my God, we've got to go out there and clean this thing up. So I actually developed a proposal to go out with a cargo ship and 2 decommissioned fishing trawlers, a crane, a chipping machine and a cold molding machine, and my intention was to go out to the gyre, raise awareness about this issue, and begin to pick up the plastic, chip it into little bits, and cold mold it into bricks that could potentially be used as building materials in underdeveloped communities. I began talking with people who actually had been out to the gyre and were studying the plastic problem in the marine environment. And upon doing so, I realized actually that cleaning it up would be a very small drop in the bucket relative to how much is being generated every day around the world. And that actually I needed to back up and look at the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is we need to find a way to turn off the faucet. We need to cut the spigot of single-use and disposable plastics, which are entering the marine environment every day on a global scale. So in looking at that, I also realized that I was really angry. I wasn't just concerned about plastic that you're trying to imagine out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, of which I've learned there are now 11 gyres potentially of plastic in 5 major oceans in the world. It's not just that gyre of plastic that I'm concerned about, it's the gyre of plastic in the supermarket. I go to the supermarket and all of my food is packaged in plastic. All of my beverages are packaged in plastic, even at the health food market. I'm also concerned about the plastic in the refrigerator. And I'm concerned about the plastic and the toxins that leach from plastic into us and into our bodies. So I came together with a group of other people who were all looking at this issue, and we created the Plastic Pollution Coalition. We have many initiatives that we're working on, but some of them are very basic. One is, if 80 to 90% of what we're finding in the ocean, of the marine debris that we're finding in the ocean is plastic, then why don't we call it what it is? It's plastic pollution. Recycling. Everybody kind of ends their books about being sustainable and greening with the idea of recycling. You put something in a bin and you don't have to think about it again. What is the reality of that? In the United States, less than 7% of our plastics are recycled. And if you really look into it, particularly when it comes to plastic bottles, most of it is only downcycled or incinerated or shipped to China. It is downcycled and turned into lesser things. While a glass bottle can be a glass bottle again or can be used again, a plastic bottle can never be a plastic bottle again. I'm a visual artist, and I'm also one of the co-founders of the Plastic Pollution Coalition. I've been working with plastic bags, which I cut up and sew back together as my primary material for my artwork for the last 20 years. I turn them into 2- and 3-dimensional pieces and sculptures and installations. Upon working with the plastic, after about the first 8 years, some of my work started to fissure and break down into smaller little bits of plastic. And I thought, great! It's ephemeral, just like us. Upon educating myself a little further about plastics, I actually realized this was a bad thing. It's a bad thing that plastic breaks down into smaller little bits because it's always still plastic. And what we're finding is there a lot of it is in the marine environment. I then, in the last few years, learned about the Pacific Garbage Patch and the gyre. And my initial reaction, and I think that this is a lot of people's first reaction to learning about it, is, oh my God, we've got to go out there and clean this thing up. So I actually developed a proposal to go out with a cargo ship and 2 decommissioned fishing trawlers, a crane, a chipping machine, and a cold molding machine. And my intention was to go out to the gyre, raise awareness about this issue, and begin to pick up the plastic, chip it into little bits, and cold mold it into bricks that could potentially be used as building materials in underdeveloped communities. I began talking with people who actually had been out to the gyre and were studying the plastic problem in the marine environment. And upon doing so, I realized actually that cleaning it up would be a very small drop in the bucket relative to how much is being generated every day around the world. And that actually I needed to back up and look at the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is we need to find a way to turn off the faucet. We need to cut the spigot of single-use and disposable plastics, which are entering the marine environment every day on a global scale. So in looking at that, I also realized that I was really angry. I wasn't just concerned about plastic that you're trying to imagine out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, of which I've learned there are now 11 gyres potentially of plastic in 5 major oceans in the world. It's not just that gyre of plastic that I'm concerned about, it's the gyre of plastic in the supermarket. I go to the supermarket and all of my food is packaged in plastic. All of my beverages are packaged in plastic, even at the health food market. I'm also concerned about the plastic in the refrigerator. And I'm concerned about the plastic and the toxins that leach from plastic into us and into our bodies. So I came together with a group of other people who were all looking at this issue, and we created the Plastic Pollution Coalition. We have many initiatives that we're working on, but some of them are very basic. One is, if 80 to 90% of what we're finding in the ocean, of the marine debris that we're finding in the ocean, is plastic, then why don't we call it what it is? It's plastic pollution. Recycling. Everybody kind of ends their books about being sustainable and greening with the idea of recycling. You put something in a bin and you don't have to think about it again. What is the reality of that? In the United States, less than 7% of our plastics are recycled. And if you really look into it, particularly when it comes to plastic bottles, most of it is only downcycled or incinerated or shipped to China. It is downcycled and turned into lesser things. While a glass bottle can be a glass bottle again or can be used again, a plastic bottle can never be a plastic bottle again.
That is the end of this task. Task 3. Lunch Lines. Listen to a conversation between tutor and school volunteer Kenny Thompson and the students Dakota Gibson and Gary Barber about a problem at a Texan school. Complete the table below by writing down the correct information. You need not write complete sentences. You will hear the recording twice. After listening, you will have some extra time to complete the task. You now have 1 minute to read the task below. The recording starts now.
It is Friday morning, which is when we hear from StoryCorps, and today we have a conversation from Texas. Until recently, a lot of poor students in the Spring Branch Independent School District dreaded lunchtime because the cafeteria meant humiliation. Their parents could not afford a hot lunch, so many kids were given a cold cheese sandwich instead. Anyone seen leaving that lunch line with a cold cheese sandwich was marked as being poor. Until a school volunteer named Kenny Thompson saw this happen. Thompson talked about his reaction with 13-year-old Gary Barber and 15-year-old Dakota Gibson.
I was mentoring someone who's in elementary school, and usually I always walk them through the lunch line, and I remember the lady behind the counter said, "Oh no, baby, I told you yesterday, you need to bring some money in here if you want to eat, so you can't have that today." I reached for my pocket. I didn't have any cash on me. And I immediately thought of you guys. Like, man, is this a problem with my other guys? Yeah, it bothered me very much. I come from a single family household. My mom struggled. And I was one of those kids that didn't know how I was going to eat at school every day. So after this happened, I went to my car, I broke down and cried, came back and talked to the principal. That's when I found out it was 66 kids that can't pay for their lunch. So I made a promise then that I was going to pay off everybody's balance. Didn't care what it cost.
The day after, I walked into the cafeteria and a whole bunch of people were looking at me. And I'm like looking around, make sure nothing was like my hair wasn't messed up or anything. But then all my friends were like, dude, your mentor paid off a whole bunch of students' lunches. That's awesome.
I saw it firsthand. My friend got to keep his lunch, and I could not put my happiness into words. It felt like a great weight was lifted off all the students' shoulders. And I was really, really proud of you.
That's cool. Thanks. I feel the same way about you guys. It's a pleasure and an honor to be there with you every week. You guys teach me how to be a better person. So I get a lot out of it, too.
Hey, that's school volunteer Kenny Thompson with two of the kids he mentors, Gary Barber and Dakota Gibson. Now, because of Thompson's efforts, two school districts in Houston have changed their lunch policies. All kids get the same lunch. It is Friday morning, which is when we hear from StoryCorps, and today we have a conversation from Texas. Until recently, a lot of poor students in the Spring Branch Independent School District dreaded lunchtime because the cafeteria meant humiliation. Their parents could not afford a hot lunch, so many kids were given a cold cheese sandwich instead. Anyone seen leaving that lunch line with a cold cheese sandwich was marked as being poor. Until a school volunteer named Kenny Thompson saw this happen. Thompson talked about his reaction with 13-year-old Gary Barber and 15-year-old Dakota Gibson.
I was mentoring someone who's in elementary school, and usually I always walk them through the lunch line, and I remember the lady behind the counter said, "Oh no, baby, I told you yesterday, you need to bring some money in here if you want to eat, so you can't have that today." I reached for my pocket. I didn't have any cash on me. And I immediately thought of you guys. Like, man, is this a problem with my other guys? Yeah, it bothered me very much. I come from a single family household. My mom struggled. And I was one of those kids that didn't know how I was going to eat at school every day. So after this happened, I went to my car, I broke down and cried, came back and talked to the principal. That's when I found out it was 66 kids that can't pay for their lunch. So I made a promise then that I was going to pay off everybody's balance. Didn't care what it cost.
The day after, I walked into the cafeteria and a whole bunch of people were looking at me. And I'm like looking around, make sure nothing was like my hair wasn't messed up or anything. But then all my friends were like, dude, your mentor paid off a whole bunch of students' lunches. That's awesome.
I saw it firsthand. My friend got to keep his lunch and I could not put my happiness into words. It felt like a great weight was lifted off all the students' shoulders. And I was really, really proud of you.
That's cool. Thanks. I feel the same way about you guys. It's a pleasure and an honor to be there with you every week. You guys teach me how to be a better person. So I get a lot out of it, too.
Hey, that's school volunteer Kenny Thompson with two of the kids he mentors, Gary Barber and Dakota Gibson. Now, because of Thompson's efforts, two school districts in Houston have changed their lunch policies. All kids get the same lunch.
That is the end of this task. That is the end of your listening comprehension examination.